Welcome, everyone. My name is Raymond Davies from PricewaterhouseCoopers. I'm your chair for this afternoon's session, and Dr. Susan Gaget, sorry, that's not quite right, is a researcher currently working with ISCRA, the Institute for Safety, Compensation and Recovery Research at Monash University. So Sue is a clinical physiotherapist for 15 years before becoming interested in economics and studying health economics. Sue has lectured at Queensland University of Technology before starting on a PhD in the economics of the Australian nursing home industry. Sue's research interests are the effectiveness and efficiency of return to work programs and the use of economic incentives in promoting return to work outcomes. Sue's also completed her third year of the Canadian Institute of Health Research's Work Disability Prevention Training Program. Congratulations on all of those achievements. So this is all around incentives for rehiring injured workers. Thanks.
Thank you. So today I'm presenting the findings of a literature review that I've recently completed for WorkSafe Victoria. And it was on workers' compensation programs to encourage new employers to hire a previously injured worker and a worker that's unable to return to their original employment. The types of programs the review were interested in were those that offer some type of financial incentive to the new employer to hire the previously injured worker. So the purpose of the review was to establish what programs exist nationally and internationally, what were the features of the programs, and what is the evidence of the impact of the programs on return to work outcomes. So more specifically, the programs of primary interest to the review were those that provided a direct incentive to hire the worker. So the employer only got the benefit if the worker was hired. There was a number of different types of programs that were of secondary interest to the review, and these included work trials and on-the-job training programs. And these were differentiated in the review as that hiring the worker is typically not a condition of those types of programs. The other types of programs that were of secondary interest were those that are offered by government agencies, government departments, for employers hiring someone with a disability. So they were of interest because we were looking at what other types of arrangements are out there for comparable or similar populations. The search for the secondary interest programs was restricted, so today I'm concentrating on describing the features of the programs that provide a direct incentive to hire the worker. I'll outline the very limited evidence that I could find in terms of the impact of the programs on return to work outcomes. One of the findings of the review was that implementation issues is a major barrier facing these types of programs and limiting their uptake. So I'll outline some of the issues that were highlighted in the literature in relation to implementation issues. And then lastly, the other feature that I noticed was the options that are suggested to try and improve awareness and uptake. So I'll outline some of those as well. A four-stage approach was used to conduct the review. So firstly, the peer-reviewed literature was searched for new employment incentive programs in a workers' compensation context. Literature from 1990 in English, the search was limited to that scope. Secondly, over 40 workers' compensation schemes, the websites of these schemes were searched to determine whether or not a program of this nature was offered in the jurisdiction. And these were Australian, US and Canadian schemes that were searched. Thirdly, using the titles of the programs that were identified in the second step, the titles of the programs were then used to research the academic literature. And fourthly, a range of government department websites and online publications to do with departments that supported the employment of those with a disability were searched. So for the Department of Education, Employment and Workplace Relations. Also, the third-party motor accident insurance schemes of Australia, the state and territory schemes, New Zealand's Accident Compensation Commission, and also the publication list of three research institutes, Institute for Work and Health, Workers' Compensation Research Institute in the US, and also the Cochrane Collaboration. So there are a number of limitations of the methodology that was used. So firstly, the search was not exhaustive, so potentially some relevant programs were missed. Most of the information on the programs that were identified has come from grey literature sources rather than peer-reviewed sources. And lastly, the quality of the studies that were identified and considered relevant to the review wasn't assessed. So very briefly, from the searches of the workers' compensation websites, 10 programs were identified, 5 Australian, 4 in the US and 1 from Canada. Fairly detailed information on 8 of the programs were available. In 2 of the jurisdictions, the programs involved being able to negotiate incentive arrangements. So there was limited available information on those jurisdictions just because it's negotiated on a case-by-case basis. There was a range of work trials and on-the-job training programs identified. Little evidence, as I've indicated, on the effectiveness on the programs. I found data related to the outcomes of a program for one of these, the US program, and I also found 1 peer-reviewed paper specifically on a workers' comp program for new employers. But as I mentioned, there's a range of similar initiatives for employers employing those with a disability, and there's been some reports and evaluation on those programs and also on some tax incentives. So there's been some effectiveness studies of those types of initiatives. So these are the names of the programs, the 8 programs that were identified. So firstly, WorkSafe Incentive Scheme for employers, the WISE program in Victoria, the JobCover Placement program in New South Wales, the Re-Employment Incentive Scheme for employers, the RISE program in South Australia, Alternative Employer Incentive Scheme in the Northern Territory. In Canada, in Nova Scotia, the Employment Incentives Program. 3 programs in the US, all referred to as the Preferred Worker Program in Oregon, North Dakota and Washington. And then the 2 jurisdictions that had the arrangements where the incentives could be negotiated were in Ohio and also for the private sector in the ACT. Unsurprisingly, there's a range, there's variations across these programs. Some are fairly restrictive, both in terms of the range and the duration of the benefits that are available. Some are quite comprehensive and flexible. Some are purely targeted at new employers, which was the focus of this review. Some of these, though, also allow for interstate employers to access some of the benefits. Some of them also are applicable to time of injury employers. Some of them also, as well as providing for benefits for the employers, they also provide benefits for the injured worker. So this is just a summary slide of the 8 programs. So down the left-hand side are the main types of incentives included in the programs. So for example, across all but 1 of the programs, some sort of wage subsidy or some other incentive type payment was available. Salary exemption, so the worker's salary could be excluded from the calculation of the workers' compensation premium, the employer's workers' compensation premium for a period of time. The employer could be protected from the cost impacts of aggravations of the original injury. Less commonly, the employer could be protected from the cost impact of a new injury. Workplace modifications and accommodation. I need to comment on this one. This slide summarises whether or not it's a feature of the new employer incentive scheme. But in a lot of jurisdictions, they may well have workplace modifications as a separate standalone program. So this is not indicating whether these benefits are offered in the jurisdiction, just whether or not they're a feature of the scheme. And lastly, employment expenses. So you can see the 2 most commonest incentives, wage subsidies or some other type of incentive payments, and also cost protection from aggravations of the original injury. Looking vertically, the Oregon and the North Dakota programs appear to be the most comprehensive in terms of the range of benefits offered. So looking more specifically at each of the different types of incentives offered, so wage subsidies or incentive payments. So they could either be a set amount per week or they could be a percentage of the employee's salary. So that first example there, $400 a week for the first 12 weeks, $500 a week for weeks 13 to 26, and $600 a week for weeks 27 to 52, is the feature offered in the New South Wales program. In the Victorian and South Australian program, it's a percentage of the worker's wage, 30 to 40%, for a 12-month period. How it operates in the Oregon and North Dakota programs is the third dot point. So they base their subsidy on the severity of the worker's injury. So typically it's 50% of the salary for 6 months, but if the workers suffered a severe injury and they're left with an exceptional disability, that was their terms, it's 75% for 12 months. In the Northern Territory and the Nova Scotia scheme, it's slightly different. In those jurisdictions, it's associated with the worker, the employer, providing training prior to employment. So, for example, that is the dot points for the Nova Scotia scheme. So initially, the worker is engaged in a work term and they're trained and 100% of their salary is subsidised. The subsidy reduces over time, and if the employer hires the worker into a permanent and full-time position, the loan is forgiven, so the subsidy provided for the wage. There is variation across the schemes in terms of the wage the subsidy is based on. So some of the schemes include things like overtime and superannuation, whereas those factors are excluded in some of the other schemes. Usually in relation to this feature, there was no mention that I could locate off a website in terms of what happens if the employee transfers to another new employer within the benefit period. Within the Oregon scheme, it specifically highlighted that this wage subsidy was to be able to be used twice. So it could be either used once each with two different employers, or could be used twice by the same employer if they changed the duties. So it was suggested that this could be used initially to help the worker find temporary employment and then subsequently a more permanent position. The salary exemption benefit was available in four of the schemes, New South Wales, Oregon, North Dakota and Washington. In New South Wales it was available for 3 years. In the three US programs, New South Wales it's available for 2 years. In the three US programs it's available for a 3 year benefit period. Again, the Oregon scheme offers somewhat different benefits to the other scheme. There was no limit on the number of times new employers could access this benefit. This feature of the program. So if an injured worker subsequently went to a new employer 6 years afterwards, that employer was also entitled to a 3 year benefit period. So the salary is excluded from the estimation of the employer's workers' compensation premium. It's slightly different in the other two US schemes. If the worker transfers to a new employer, a subsequent new employer, the benefit period, they receive the benefit for the remainder of the 3 year period, the initial 3 year period, but it is not renewed. They don't get the full 3 year period. Protection from the cost of subsequent injuries is another incentive commonly included in these programs. So typically the employer is protected from the cost impacts of claims and premium impacts of aggravations of the original injury, and less frequently in regard to new injuries. In some jurisdictions, the employer may have to pay the cost excess of a new injury, but may be protected from the cost impacts in terms of their workers' comp premium. Again, the Oregon program is a little different. In Oregon, the employers are protected from the cost of subsequent claims whenever the worker is employed under the salary exemption benefit period. So each new subsequent employer is entitled to the 3-year salary exemption period, and they also get protection from the cost of subsequent claims during that period. Workplace modification and accommodation costs. So, as I mentioned, this may well be a standalone program that is not part of a new employer incentives program. Typically, there was nothing outlining the funding amounts provided, again, except in terms of Oregon. They're allowing up to $25,000 modifications, and even this could be negotiated if the person had suffered a severe catastrophic injury. One of the other features that I guess it just struck me that it was to do with a training program, an on-the-job training program in BC. So if they were implementing a workplace modification to assist a worker on a training program, and if the other workers were likely to benefit from the initiative, they could negotiate cost-sharing arrangements with the employer. So clearly there's variations across the schemes in terms of who is and who isn't eligible to the different features. So 3 of the programs allowed interstate or Commonwealth employers or federal employers were able to potentially access some of the benefits. So for example, in the New South Wales scheme, interstate and Commonwealth employers were able to access the financial incentive payments, but they were not able to access protection from the cost of subsequent claims or the salary exemption benefit. Another one of the schemes that did this was the Ohio scheme, and how it worked there was interstate employers were potentially able to access negotiated arrangements if a reasonable but unsuccessful effort had already been undertaken in terms of searching for employment within Ohio, but that had been unsuccessful. Some of the schemes included conditions in regard to the position that the employee was being employed into. So, for example, some of them specified the minimum number of hours that the worker had to be employed for. Some of them specified the minimum length of time the worker had to be employed for, whereas in other schemes, temporary and casual employment positions were potentially eligible for these benefits. Another feature that differentiated the schemes were there were conditions in regards to some of the workers. So this was in the Oregon and North Dakota schemes. So even though they appear to be more generous and more comprehensive, they actually had conditions in regards to which workers were eligible. So they referred to the workers that are eligible as preferred workers, and the preferred worker had to have some sort of permanent restriction that was preventing them returning to their regular work that had not been modified. So, for example, if they were given release to return to their regular work without any restriction, they become ineligible for the program. So those programs are therefore slightly more targeted than some of the other programs. I've kept highlighting the Oregon features, and it does seem to be the one that some of the other jurisdictions, especially in the US, compared themselves with. I think I've mentioned all of those. The other feature of the Oregon program and the North Dakota program that I haven't mentioned is that they also include a range of benefits that the injured worker can access to try and help them find and maintain a position. So, for example, there are amounts where the injured worker can hire a vocational counsellor to help them find a job. There's amounts for tuition, for skills updating, for mandatory tools for the position, employment, uniforms, moving expenses, if they had to go undergo a medical examination, if they have to go undergo drug screening arrangements, for union fees, worksite creation costs, and that was in relation to fitting out an office equipment, furniture, computers, so that's actually a benefit for the employer rather than the employee, and also miscellaneous costs. And the only thing I could find out about that one was that it didn't include a car. Not that you're going to get a car for $2,500. Another strong feature of the Oregon program was that there was no time limit on when the eligible when the preferred worker was able to start accessing the benefits. So there was a similar list of employment expenses benefits in the North Dakota program. So this just outlines the features of the ACT and the program in Ohio, and this is where the benefits can be negotiated with a new employer on a case-by-case basis. There was also a range of work trials and on-the-job training programs identified, and in the review I differentiated these because typically there's no condition for hiring the worker. If an employer or a host employer takes on someone that they're going to offer work experience to or specific job training, I mean, essentially they gain the benefit of an experienced worker for a period of time, and the worker's employment wage is either fully subsidised or it's cost-shared. However, what the employer also gets is first-hand knowledge of the suitability of that person for that position. And it's through that secondary benefit, if you like, that the worker's employment may be facilitated. So these were of relevance to the review, but it wasn't a direct hiring incentive, if you like. Typically, the work trials were for shorter periods, a few weeks to months, and they were fully subsidised. The work training programs, the on-the-job training programs were more variable. They were often for longer, for 3 to 6 months. Often there was an initial fully subsidised month period, and then the subsidy reduced as the training needs also reduced. I haven't got time to go into the details of some of the other similar initiatives that were identified, but the TAC in Victoria, the Transport Accident Commission, offers a program to both new and existing employers called the Employers Incentives Package, and in that they have a graded wage subsidy. So it was a little different from the other programs I'd found. They assess the worker's productivity. So if the worker comes back and is doing X number of hours and they're assessed as 70% productive, the employer is subsidised 30% of that worker's wage for the hours worked. So a little different. There's also a range of Australian government subsidies on offer, both for employers that employ a worker with a disability and also for workplace modification costs. And I think there was about 4 levels of subsidies that were provided, and these varied based on the length of time the worker may have been unemployed, and also for the length of time that they have to employ the worker for. There was a work trial available in New Zealand's Accident Compensation Corporation. There are also a whole range of variations in what are referred to as second or subsequent injury funds, mainly in the US and also in Canada. This is where the funds are available if the employer has a worker who had a previous condition or injury and they subsequently have a work-related compensable injury that is made substantially worse by their existing condition. So if that's the situation, then these funds are available potentially after the compensation has been completed for the work-related injury. And there was no intention initially to search for tax incentives. It was just that on some of the websites, the US websites for injured workers, they actually promoted the availability of a number of tax incentive schemes available in the US for employers who hire a worker with a disability. The tax incentive schemes were not specifically targeted at those with a disability. They were one of the target groups. It was for workers with some disadvantage, typically. So it could be unemployed youth or veterans or long-term unemployed. So workers with a disability were one of the target groups for these sort of tax incentives. Impact on return to work outcomes. So that was one of the objectives of the review, to assess the available evidence. Little was found. I was able to locate some data from the Oregon scheme that is reported in its annual report on the scheme. What they do in this jurisdiction is compare data for two groups of eligible workers. So preferred workers who are eligible to access the benefits of the scheme, and they compare the outcomes for those who do access the benefits compared to those who don't. And they look at two measures, employment rates and wage recovery rates, in approximately 3 years post-injury. And they report the differences in terms of percentage point differences. So, for example, in 2005, for those who used the benefits of the scheme, the employment rates, the red line, was approximately 25% higher than the employment rates in those who didn't access the benefits of the scheme. So you can see over recent years, those outcome measures for those who have accessed the benefits of the scheme are substantially higher. But there is a caveat attached to these outcome data. Any other factors that might explain these results are not accounted for. Okay, so apart from the fact that one group have used the benefits and one group haven't, there's been no other control of other external factors in terms of these results. So that was the only specific data on a workers' compensation scheme that I could locate. But there were a number of surveys of Australian employers in regards to their attitudes on using financial incentives to hire a worker with a disability. And there was also a number of studies on the impact of the tax schemes in the US. I guess another caveat, if you like, one of the studies specifically of employers on the use of financial incentives was looking at strategies to encourage employers to take on those who need a high level of assistance. So how applicable the findings of these studies are to a workers' compensation context is up for debate, and you need to be aware of that when you consider the results of the studies. And generally, the employer surveys found that there was strong support for the use of financial wage subsidies, if you like, in taking on a worker with a disability. The support was higher among the medium and larger employers as opposed to the smaller employers. However, the subsidies weren't seen as a critical factor in determining whether or not the worker was employed. The critical factor was whether or not the worker was the right person for the job and the worker's productivity at the end of the subsidy period. There wasn't universal support for them. Some of the employers considered that it might reinforce fears that worker isn't the right person for the job and that the incentive is there to cover up inadequate performance. However, there were also employers that said that they wouldn't take on a worker with a disability if there wasn't some sort of financial support with upfront costs. Of course, in their opinion, taking on a worker with a disability shouldn't cost the employer more. In terms of the results of the tax credit programs for disadvantaged populations, they're mixed results. Some found positive higher employment rates from these initiatives. Other studies said that found the positive rates were only in the short term and not in the medium to long term. So the other thing that struck me when I was reading through the literature was it was continually highlighted the implementation that these implementation barriers, if you like, that these types of programs faced. And again, these are more to do with general programs for those with a disability as opposed to workers' compensation programs specifically. The first issue was the lack of employer awareness of the programs. So a study of employer awareness of the US tax credits, they found 37% of employers were aware of the program, but then when they asked about specific detailed knowledge of the key feature, only 17% were knowledgeable of the feature. Another survey of small businesses in California, and this was asking them about awareness of a subsidy scheme for workplace modifications, only 10% of employers eligible for the program were aware that it existed. The one paper that I did find specifically on a workers' compensation program encouraging new employers to hire previously injured workers was a review of the Florida Preferred Worker Program that was available in the 1990s, and it was a review of why the program had failed. The benefit offered was reimbursement of the cost of the workers' comp premium for the injured worker for 3 years. So that was the only incentive that was offered. There was no cost protection from subsequent injuries, modifications, etc. So in the author's opinion, the incentive was inadequate. It didn't outweigh the potential costs of the action, which is hiring a worker who had had a previous compensable work-related injury. Another feature that was highlighted in a number of the studies was where employers got their information from and what source of information they trusted about these types of programs. So from the surveys, the employers or the businesses, there was issues around government involvement in business activities, and employers' preferred source of information about these types of initiatives were within their business networks, so networks that they trusted, so their own trade and professional associations, local chambers of commerce, human resource associations. It was only after they had experience with the program or they had greater knowledge of it that government sources or rehab agencies also became a preferred source of information. So the inference by the authors of that study was that the business's preferred source of information is a trusted source that they already have an established relationship with. Another issue that could impact the implementation and uptake of these types of programs is the workers' perspective. Typically these programs in North America, it's up to the worker to determine whether or not they inform a prospective employer that if they weren't hired, that the employer is potentially eligible for the range of benefits. So the issue of whether or not the injured worker wants to disclose to a prospective employer their history, their status as having a previous compensable work-related injury was raised in a number of the studies. There was one study, it was comments from participants in a work trial in the UK, and the participants objected to working for an employer for no wage, even though they were receiving their compensation benefits. To them, they felt that offered them little incentive. I guess also from a broader perspective, the use of wage subsidies or financial incentives, there can be some broader scale efficiency implications. So there can be something referred to as deadweight loss. So where an employer is paid a subsidy to employ the worker, but they would have hired that worker irrespective of the incentive. So there can be efficiency issues there. The other efficiency, broader scale efficiency issue is if you're using subsidies to hire particular workers or to create particular jobs, essentially you may be displacing other workers or other positions in the economy. So not that this is going to influence whether or not a workers' compensation jurisdiction may offer financial incentives to improve return to work outcomes, it's fair enough to acknowledge that there could be some broader scale negative consequences for others. So, given the issues that are discussed in the literature about the implementation, I guess when I was reviewing the websites, I became aware of features that some of the jurisdictions were using that I felt personally could help to address some of these implementation barriers. So these are some of the processes that different workers' comp schemes are using currently that, in my opinion, might help reduce some of the barriers. So, for example, the communication one, they're options that the Oregon program offers. So they use a whole range of communication channels to try and promote the awareness of their program to different stakeholders. So, for example, they have a quarterly newsletter that is sent out to preferred workers, so workers who are eligible for the benefits of the program but haven't accessed the benefits. There are also online updates that employers can subscribe to outlining the benefits and details of the program. Also, through their website, you can look up success stories. So these are stories by injured workers and employers who have accessed the benefits of the program and the benefits that they felt they gained through their participation in the program. Re-employment specialist, that was in the North Dakota scheme. They employ a re-employment specialist whose job it is to find positions for previously injured workers with employers throughout the state by actively engaging with these workers. Oregon and North Dakota use ID cards, so it's a little card that identifies an eligible worker as a preferred worker, and then it's up to the worker as to whether or not they present this card to their prospective employer, informing them of their potential eligibility for the benefits. A number of the schemes use online job matching sites. Some of these are, so the employer posts a job vacancy online. Some of the sites are monitored by rehab agencies and employment support organisations, and they then look through their list of candidates, select suitable candidates they think might be suitable for the position. The Oregon site isn't monitored. They are slightly different again. They allow the worker to contact the employer directly, and they also have a system where they can send email updates to the injured workers, alerting them whenever there's a new position that's come online. Also, one of the jurisdictions had an online cost calculator so that employers could estimate the cost savings they could get if they participated in the program. These were options that were in relation to general support programs for those with a disability. So these were not specifically workers' compensation context. So things like using high-level task forces or industry forums to provide strategic direction and leadership on priorities for employment services for those with a disability, greater involvement of top management. There was also a call for greater collaboration between employment providers and rehab agencies to work more collaboratively with the sources of information that employers may seek information about these types of programs from. So, for example, work more collaboratively with local chambers of commerce. There was even one report that suggested that the employment support personnel could go and do some work experience with businesses just to gain a greater understanding of business, how businesses operate and business ethos. Calls for one-stop shops and single points of information to make it easier for employers to access the information they need. There was also a strong call that employers valued information from other employers, so their experiences and their ideas of what works and what doesn't work. This was a list of critical factors from one of the surveys of the Australian employers that they felt was necessary for the success of an employment support program for those with a disability. So there's nothing special or surprising about any of these, but I guess, if you like, it provides a checklist of factors that, if addressed, may help to address some of the barriers that are out there. So, for example, the incentives had to be tailored to the specific context. They had to be targeted to try and reduce inefficiencies and waste. They had to be offered as an integrated package of measures for employers. There had to be sufficient details on the incentives, but there also had to be information of broader implications that's relevant to employers, such as regulations. Application and administration processes had to be streamlined, non-time-consuming, easy to access. And they also suggested that, obviously, key employer and industry groups needed to be involved, especially if the initiative was developing information campaigns or a campaign to try and change employer attitudes towards the issue.
Sue. Oh, rightio, we're up to... In summary. Okay, good.
Yes. In summary. So, as we all know, return to work for workers with a compensable injury is complicated by the multi-stakeholder environment that it operates in, and for those unable to return to their original employment, the challenges could be even greater. Though there is some positive data in relation to the program, and there's been a recent OECD report that has called for the strengthening of the use of employment incentives for the injured workers, the lack of evidence on the impact or the effectiveness of these programs obviously calls for some caution in this. The other issue that obviously has to be addressed is the implementation challenges, and it's likely that a one-shoe-fits-all may not be as effective as programs that are aware of and address the local context issues. So, acknowledgements, the project was funded by WorkSafe Victoria through the Institute for Safety Compensation and Recovery Research.
Afternoon tea is at 3:15. Are there one or two questions, comments?
In terms of the research you undertook, did you see any differentiation at all between injury type, physical and or, say, non-physical stress claim? Was there any evidence that perhaps said that we need to do those in a different way as it relates to an incentive program?
No, there was very little on the workers' compensation context in the literature at all. Like, most of the literature was about general disability support programs. And no, they didn't. And so that's much broader, and it's not just disability, potentially low income, unemployed youth. So you've got this issue of how people do this to work as a compensation context. So that has to be acknowledged as the limitation, how they can be adapted, potentially, for the investigation.
We'll make this the last one. Thank you. Sorry, everything's being recorded. If you wouldn't mind.
Oh, you mentioned that there was a report from the OECD saying that we should be doing these kinds of things. So despite the limited evidence, from what you've had a look at, which one of these programs would you sort of recommend? I mean, just...
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you for giving us something new.